second case for today is Barron versus Barron. This is a case which is set for 1 hour. May I have your good appearances, please?
Good morning, Justice. Madam Chief Justice, Richard Westfall for the petitioner, Marion Barron.
Thank you, and
good morning. Alan Sweetbaum, I'll be sitting at council table with Mr. Westfall, but will not be presenting any argument today.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Blaine Myrie on behalf of respondent David Barron, and I will be dividing argument time with Mr. Brigham.
Mr. Brigham.
Charles Wiggison, represent three of the sons, Deb, Daniel, Johnson.
Okay, thanks. I want to inform counsel that Justice Hood will not be participating in this case. So we are a six-person court for this case. The case is set for 1 hour, as I indicated, and it's posted that each side has 30 minutes. Mr. Westfall, you'll have to keep track of your own time, if you will, sir, and also if you don't have any bubbles, keep track of that. As between you and Mr. Meyer and Mr. Brady, you'll have to divide up your own time as you see fit, but you have 30 minutes to divide. All right, whenever you're ready, you're ready to go, Mr. Westfall.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. Richard Westfall of the firm Hale Westfall for petitioner Marion Barron. With me at council table is Mr. Sifong, who's representing three of the beneficiaries in this case, Joshua Barron, Dina Grossman, and the estate of Cheryl Feldberg. I will primarily address the issue of the probate court's equitable power under 1510.103 of the probate code. I will underscore why the elective share statute does not displace the probate court's equitable power, and why an equitable adjustment was called for on this record. I will touch upon why, even if this court determines that the probate court did not have equitable power in this case, why, in this case, a general remand is still called for to allow the probate court to address the probate of this estate, really in the first instance under the new ground rules. Under the legal framework, this court determined should apply. And lastly, of course, I will answer any questions the court may have on the interest issue raised in the cross petition. The probate court below relied expressly on probate code section 1510.103. That section is very short and reads as follows. Unless displaced by the particular provisions of this code, the principles of law and equity supplement its provisions. There are many reasons why the probate court was correct in believing it had equitable power to probate this case and deal with the elective share case below. First, the controlling case law. I will submit to this court that there are four cases that the court should particularly look carefully at in assessing the correctness of the probate court's decision. The first case is the case that was relied upon expressly by the probate court below, a 1986 Colorado Court of Appeals case, Estate of Smith. Estate of Smith expressly, plain from the plain language of the opinion, exercised equity to adjust the elective share based upon the delay in time. There is no question, urge the court to read it, the court was exercising equity, not monkeying in any way with the calculation of the elective share, but saying, look, I'm going to exercise equity, and I'm going to enhance the elective share based upon equity, and use the words more to our interest. That's what the court did. That's what the probate court did below. In this case, relied on that from the very beginning, cited that case and relied upon it from the very beginning. And I respectfully submit there's nothing in the 1994 amendments to the probate code that were being relied upon both by the respondents and by the Court of Appeals below that in any way show any attempt to try to address a state of Smith. A state of Smith was good law, and it remains good law today. The second case this court should look to is the Lunsford case. That case, I want to note a couple of things that are particularly important about the Lunsford case. First, It dealt with specifically the statute we're dealing with here, 1510.103 of the probate code. Second, there was the same kind of argument that was being raised by the respondents and was relied upon the Court of Appeals below on what the dissent, Chief Justice Wallach, characterized as field preemption. The case for field preemption, using the Slater statute, let me take a step back to what Lunsford was all about. The Lunsford was about the Slater statute, which deals with a specific situation that was at issue in that case, which was the payment of life insurance proceeds to someone who later turned out to be was the person who murdered the victim and who had a life insurance policy. And so the plaintiffs in that case, who were successful in this court, argued that irrespective of the Slater statute, there was a separate common law duty on the part of an insurance company to not be negligent in distribution of insurance proceeds, life insurance proceeds, especially being negligent, and distributing those proceeds to the person who ended up being the murderer in the case, and ended up pleading guilty to that. And this court, over a very strong dissent of three justices led by Chief Justice Wallach, made a very compelling case for field preemption, saying the duties that were established in the Slater statute were precisely the kind of duties that the insurance company could rely upon to deal with, say, the Slater statute. So long as we comply with it, we have no separate common law duty. And this court rejected that and said, absent a explicit legislative direction to the contrary, the duties of the insurance, common law duties of the insurance company remain. I would note that the Court of Appeals below specifically noted that the elective share statute is silent on the issue of the probate court's equity. Silent. The third case I would submit to this court to look to is Vigil versus Franklin. Vigil versus Franklin, 2004, I believe, talked about a clear expression being required for the General Assembly to displace common law. And in that case, this court found there was, in fact, that clear expression. The language that was specifically looked to by this court were the phrases in the, in that case, it's the premises liability statute. That case, in this court, looked at the language that said, where it says, any civil action, that's from the premises liability statute, any civil action, first phrase was important, and that the recovery could be had on any civil action involving premises liability only as provided. Those three key words. This court said that constituted a clear expression by the General Assembly to show that the General Assembly intended to displace common law in that particular situation. The fourth case is a more recent case.
Okay, so before you continue on in your case discussion, I'm just wondering, can you tell me, though, how VHL applies here in this instance? What I understand your opposing counsel to be arguing here in a few minutes would be the statute here says the elective share is to be determined this way. And you're saying the elective share should be determined that way, which is inconsistent. And can you tell me why that isn't similar to what happened in VHL?
That is not the argument that we're making to this court.
Okay.
We are in no way challenging the calculation of the elective share below. The calculation of the elective, in fact, I think all parties can see the calculator, there was tremendous energy and effort that went into making sure the elective share was calculated properly. We are not challenging that in any fashion. Just because there is a legal claim for an elective share, we submit, does not supplant or displace a probate court from looking at a particular situation, a particular case, probate case, and saying, shouldn't an equitable award, or at least being able to consider and have the power to consider whether an exercise of equity is appropriate in a given situation on top of the elective share case. The Henderson case that I'm going to turn to really speaks to that, Justice Ott. You had a situation where January 2014, this court held that despite a 6-year statute of limitations, the equitable doctrine of latches could apply. And if you look at both in the discussion of the opinion itself, and especially in footnote 3 of that, the Hickerson case, This court specifically said, irrespective if you have a legal claim, so long as you have the requisite basis for an overlay of an equitable doctrine that latches on top of that, that's well established law by this court.
Well, I guess you're saying that your insertion of equity doesn't affect the statutory determination of the elective share at all. Is that your position?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
You can absolutely, and I've got it right here, we can walk through the elective share statute, and it was complied with in every single instance. And in contrast to the Munster case, where you really do get in a situation where, at least per Chief Justice Bawa and two other justices on this court, there was a case that you were claiming conflicting duties, if you will, the duties that were set forth in the Slayer statute versus the duties that were set forth in common law. Here, there's nothing you can point to that's even remotely expressly conflicting with an exercise of equity on the one hand and calculating and determining the elective share on the other. They completely coincide with harmony. There is no conflict. And that's why you look at Lunsford, you look at Vigil, you look at Hickerson, that's why some of those cases really do should compel this court to conclude that the probate court was accurate that it had equitable power.
Well, then all the standard review is that we defer to that as long as the probate court has facts that support the decision that equity needs to intervene here because of an injustice, a delay, etc.
Yeah. Absolutely, Justice. In the 2000, as we know in our strongly in our reply brief, nowhere in the briefs, despite the respondents' attempts to re-argue the equities, if you will, before this court, the probate court made three specific. First, the key decision is the 2009 decision on the equitable award that was by the probate court. And in that, the probate court specifically, this is, I believe, the definitive ruling that this court should look to make the determination whether the probate court acted properly in exercising its equitable power. The probate court starts off by saying two things at the beginning. It says there's no place in the probate code for an award of interest. Makes that point. Second, the court makes the point, then cites 1510.103. You know, I quote this repeatedly in both our opening brief and our reply brief. Then the court makes three specific findings. Number one, the decedent's children, this is a direct quote, the decedent's children would be enriched at the expense of their mother if they were allowed to delay the distribution of the full elective share for a decade. Second finding. The decedent's children would be enriched at the expense of their mother if they could, quote, force distribution of cash to their mother while they took in-kind distributions. Third finding, the decedent's children would be enriched at the expense of their mother if they could, quote, continually reduce the value of the elective share by increasing administrative expenses through delay and obstruction, close quote. Those were the findings the probate court made. It is a basis for justifying its award of equity in this particular situation. And shock and strikingly, nowhere in the respondent's briefs and their answer brief do they take that head on. And as we point out in our reply brief, and I will elaborate more hopefully later on in my argument, if I have time permitting, that there is evidence that the record clearly establishes a sound basis for each of those three findings, Justice Hoffman. The second reason why, a second reason why the probate court was correct in determining that it had equitable power gets to an issue that really has become clearer to me as I've gotten close to preparing for this oral argument today. We noted in our reply brief, but in the 1999 trial brief that was submitted by two of the respondents on the other side, they specifically acknowledged to the probate court that under N. Ray Estate of Smith, the first case that I just talked about this morning, that in the probate court had equitable power to make a moratorium interest, the language that was used in the Estate of Smith, but they simply urged the court not to exercise that power. that was even, as I went back and looked at it, it's even stronger than I originally thought when it was originally characterized in our reply brief. I would call the attention, and it, actually, the place that you can make notes for yourself and your law clerks so that you can follow along on this and make this determination is if you go to the top of the two respondents' briefs, Mr. Riga, on page 16, they cite a series of record sites that they say show that they preserved their objection to the exercise of equity. In fact, it's quite the contrary. The first citation is on top of page 16 of their brief, is to R3452-3082. That is the reference to the 1994 trial brief that we cite in our requirement. And not only does that brief tell the probate court that it had power in equity under N. Ray Estate of Smith, it goes on to specifically urge the court to make an equitable finding. It's one thing to maybe say I'll acknowledge that maybe you have the power, but we're going to object. They specifically urge the probate court to make an equitable finding. If you look at page 9 of that brief, the conclusion, one sentence reads as follows. She should not be entitled to moratorium interest based on the equities as set forth herein. They specifically urge the probate court to make an equitable finding.
Counsel, though, what do we do with that?
It's traditional estoppel. It's invited error. It certainly should be something this court takes into consideration. And I have to go back and I can tell you, how did it get this way? The reason it got this way is if you go back and look at the Court of Appeals briefs, I'm just trying to like scratch my head. How is this only becoming clearest to me now? Here I am on the oral argument to you in this court today. It's because they never relied upon the vote in their opening briefs and their appeal. They did not even take on the issue of displacement under 1510.103. We did. We defended the probate court's exercise of equity, saying all their arguments about interest are beside the point. And what proves that more than anything else is look at the Court of Appeals decision that says, in the alternative, Mrs. Barron argues for an exercise of interest under 512.102 when it doesn't apply. No, we didn't. I pointed out in our petition for certiorari in this court, we specifically said we are not arguing that. It morphed below. And now here we are today, and we're arguing something that really was, at least two of the respondents had conceded wasn't even an issue. And now we're here today. I think that's important to bring to this court's attention. The other citation in that, and I'll move on, on the top of page 16 is the third citation there. And that is it's the second 1396571. These are, I guess, LexisNexis record citations. That is a 2007 brief, 2007, 8 years later, at page 13, acknowledging that the state of Smith still has viability, and referred to it in that case as an equitable surcharge remedy, and really argued that it shouldn't be applied in this particular case.
Could I take you back just for a second to your distinction between an equitable remedy and the elective, the spouse's elective share, the one that they are completely different. Does it make a difference in your analysis that the statute has provided for a choice for a certain amount by the spouse and that choice was made? That is, we don't have a separate cause of action or a separate type of finding. We've got a statute providing for the spouse to choose a specific share, which the statute lays out. Does it make a difference that that the spouse has made that choice, but you seem to be arguing that, nevertheless, the court can supplement that for equitable reasons?
I don't think it should, Justice Hobbs, as I think about your question. The reason is because it's a legal claim. Just because a legal claim is being exercised in a given instance, you're not waiving exercise of equity just because you bring a legal claim. That's the teaching of Dickerson. More importantly, in this particular situation, things change dramatically if you go back and look at the record. At the time that she made the election, she really thought, Mrs. Barron, honestly, God, believed she could put this whole dispute in her rearview mirror. And by just, she had a life-saving in entirety that included a provision allowed to invade the principles so long as her, she established her as a base for it. She was protected for it in life, for her lifetime, by children. She really thought, without mistaking me, that by just going the electric share route, giving a bunch of money to the residual beneficiaries, that somehow she could put this in her rearview mirror, and she was not able to do so. And so
that has to do with the finality of the probate matter. I mean, what is that? What is that policy you just argued?
I'm sorry, just
the finality of the finality of the final judgment. Is that the policy you're arguing? Why she can get more than the elective share because the delay does what? What were the practical consequences to her?
The practical consequences for her were as follows. If in fact the three sons had not, now four sons, had not, then four sons, had not thrown, Mrs. Barron filed, let me take a step back. Mrs. Barron filed a petition in January of 2000 to say that we had a dollar amount, $77 million, that had been audited by the IRS and approved by the IRS for tax purposes. She said, let's just use that number. Let's promptly distribute my half of that. That half of that would, by the way, have to include a significant amount of the oil and gas assets themselves. But let's just do a partition. Let's just split it up. Let's move on. In February of 2000, the probate court made a record order that we cite that said, I'm setting it for a half of the 80, more than that would be, quote, excessive. This is going to be a quick and easy fix. Let's move it on. And the March 2000 brief filed by David Barron, joined in April of 2000 by the other three sons, said, nope, not too fast, we're going to go back and we're going to challenge everything. And so by doing that, she would have had $37 million of her elective, which would have been her elective share in 2000. Now, if you go back and do all the calculations and 15 years of delay and the tremendous administrative expenses that she was saddled with, which, by the way, we know that in our briefing, the probate court acknowledged, it said, I know I'm sticking you with excessive administrative costs, but the equitable adjustment is going to allow, I'm going to use that to sort of make up for it, if you will. But she would have gotten $37 million. Now she could have as little as $13 million left at the end of this whole process after 15 years and be forced to pay back $24 million with interest.
So it wasn't just Judge Stewart getting exasperated about this being the oldest case on her docket?
No. Quite. It was just kept going on and going on and going on. And it finally was a recognition by the probate court. She reserved that number from day one. In her ruling, I think it's September 1999, she had gotten in total everything that the two of the respondents said. Nope, I can't. I have no power to make an interest award, but I reserve the right to exercise equity. We'll just see what happens. And it turned out to be a decade and a half long odyssey of litigation and of depriving Mrs. Barron of a good chunk of those productive oil and gas assets. Let me touch on that because I'm going to start running out of time, and I want to make sure I hit on this point. That there would not have been enough cash. She would have had productive assets. At the end of the day, the personal representative resisted it at every turn. It turns out, for very good reasons, to liquidate the oil and gas company, Bear Energy, that appreciated significantly in value up to a total distribution at the time value of in 2011 of $400 million. The personal representative concluded smartly and justifiably that liquidation would not only destroy the sort of productive value of these assets, but it also would have created huge residual tax consequences for the very residual beneficiaries who are now complaining in this courtroom. So that's the situation. That's why those three findings are so sick that Judge Stewart used to justify her exercise of equity was so well founded on this record. The third reason why the probate court was correct, a third reason, was that we're talking about an exercise of equity, not just common law. Probate courts are inherently courts of equity. Not only do we have 15, 10, 103, the central focus of this case, which we also have Colorado Revised Statute 13.9103, which also says that probate courts have the power to, you know, to adjudicate every question legal and equitable in that courtroom. I would respectfully submit that using the teachings of Lunsford, the teaching of Vigil, Hickerson, there should be a very clear expression. You're talking about an exercise of equity by a probate court in any statutory scheme before this court finds displacement.
Could I ask one point there? I'll try not to use the lures to your tongue, but you all have mentioned and brought into this the analysis of our case law that we have addressing relatively similar, very close to similar language in the Uniform Commercial Code, in the Colorado Commercial Code, in which we seem to have more recently said, in order to eliminate a common law claim to disprove, to displace a common law claim, the Commercial Code doesn't have to expressly say so or refer to a specific cause. Do you see those as related at all?
I think the Clancy and Shelby cases, which are the leading UCC cases that they rely upon, both say use the clear expression of displacement language. The standard is the same standard. But what we have, though, is those cases do say that. These are cases in this court. But in the UCC context, what you have is, let's go back to, again, once in a UCC context, when you have an avowed purpose from the General Assembly to have uniformity so that, you know, commercial transactions in Colorado are similar to Kansas and Nebraska and Wyoming and Texas and all of it, and in interstate commerce that takes place, you want to make sure that the companies that do business in interstate commerce have a clearly defined set of duties. Look at the Lunsford situation. There you have conflict, and I respectfully submit, of common law duties being established on insurance companies compared with the applicable language of the Slater statute. In that case, that wasn't clear enough. In the case of the UCC, for example, if you really do, if the General Assembly speaks to a standard of conduct for commercial purposes, that should be all that the General Assembly requires in that context. My point to you, Justice Coates, is that context matters. We're talking about sui generis, probate, involving an elected chair in a context where everybody acknowledges this is not the kind of situation. We're talking about elected chair is usually done in the context of pulling back assets to protect a disinherited spouse. Here she had a life estate, and she used it for an entirely different purpose, and things just got out of hand. Probate court, in that context, should be allowed to exercise its power of equity, particularly when you can point to not one provision of the elected chair statute that was violated in doing this. I know they have this preemption of the field argument that Chief Justice Ballot essentially urged in the Grand Slayer statute. That's not good enough under the law of this court.
Mr. Westfall, before you go, can I ask just a simple question is, what do you want our holding to be in this case?
Reversing the Court of Appeals and the court had the power to exercise equity and that there's a record basis for doing that.
Equity under what? Okay, I understand.
In other words, the August 2009 finding was well established by the probate court. 1510.103, court has power of equity, laid forth three bases for doing so. The record supports those bases. Therefore, the probate court was correct in making equitable adjustments.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, honorable opponents and co-counsel. What Mr. Westfall calls an ordinary exercise of equity is in fact nothing short of judicial legislation. The comprehensive statutory scheme for the elective share was fundamentally changed in 1994. The fractional interest regime before 1994 specified that the electing spouse got a fractional interest of the estate at date of distribution. In other words, value at date of distribution. In 1994, the Colorado General Assembly amended that to be consistent with the new Uniform Probate Code, to require the elective share to be a pecuniary amount, a sum certain, determined as a date of death value. The statute in Colorado creates a pure mathematical formula for the probate court to apply. There is no room to alter that formula absent legislation that allows the court to do so. I would like to walk briefly through how the statute works. The initial goal in determining the elective share is first to determine the augmented estate value, and that is the term used in the statute. 1511-202-2 defines the augmented estate mathematically as the sum of four distinct values. One, the value of the decedent's probate estate, reduced by funeral and administrative expenses, family allowance, exempt property, and enforceable claims. Two, the value of the decedent's non-probate transfers to the surviving spouse. Three, the value of non-probate transfers to others. And four, the value of other statutorily defined property, including the spouse's own property. So the augmented estate is determined as a mathematical formula, A plus B plus C plus D. That gives the augmented estate value. That is what the statute requires to determine. Then, to determine the elective share, you apply the percentage from 1511-201. In this case, and the percentage is based on the length of the marriage. For marriages of 10 years or longer, as in this case, 50%. So the mathematical formula, the sum of A plus B plus C plus D, is then multiplied by the percentage, 50% in this case, to give the elective share amount. That is what the elective share amount is. There is nothing in the statute that permits that to be altered. And to alter it, whether it's called moratory interest or an equitable adjustment, is the equivalent of the probate court adding an additional figure onto the elective share amount.
So the court has no power in the face of injustice, manifest injustice, whatever it is we have in this case or other cases, to in any way deter conduct that impedes wrapping this up and getting a final judgment.
But I have several comments on that. First of all, the court does not have the power absent statute to do so. Now, in the estate of Leslie case, which the petitioners rely on, in that case, some was taken out of a residuary's, take because of conduct that was frivolous and groundless litigation under 1317-102. We don't have that finding here. We have nothing close to that finding. And in fact, what they talk about being a grave injustice, I think you need to look at what happened in this case. In 2003, the court ordered the equitable adjustment. The next 6 years were spent litigating what it should be. And my client and Mr. Briga's clients said, you can't award this interest. You can't award this interest. Well, 6 years of litigation were spent trying to figure out this award by picking two values, one in December of 2000, and then later determined in December of 31 of 2007, picking the estate values, and then through complex and expensive expert reports and expert evaluations, determining an investment rate of return for the estate. So what happens is, the litigation, the moratorium interest award itself spawns additional litigation. And the other component that Mr. Westfall left out is he said Miriam Barron is satisfied to take the $73 million and get her elective share out of that. But he fails to mention that in 2001, she filed an amended petition which sought to increase the estate value by nearly $10 million and to increase her elective share value. And that led to litigation in 2002 and 2003, a full trial, and resulted in gift tax returns being filed, $3 million in gift tax penalties being incurred by the estate, and those come out of the net probate estate and thus reduce the amount of the augmented state and hence the elective share. So when we talk about grave injustice, the grave injustice here was the probate court ordering an award of moratorium interest in making the proceedings so complex and convoluted that they extended on another 7 years and resulted where we are now in proceedings that are still ongoing and with another remand yet to be had regardless of the outcome of this case.
Counsel, before you move on though, can I just get you to answer, let's just put the facts of this situation, in this case, aside for a moment, in answer to Justice Hoffman's question. Imagine actual grave injustice circumstances, okay, from your point of view. You're saying the probate court could not order interest to take into account delay. Let's just imagine purposeful delay.
The answer is no.
Under no set of circumstances.
Absent some statute that gives the ability to do
but
that.
But we don't have that, I guess, your position.
Exactly. We do in the amended statute, the 2014 statute. So in future states, there is a provision for interest. But I think it's telling to look at that interest provision, which only provides for an award of interest beginning 1 year after the elective share amount is determined. Here, the elective share amount wasn't determined until September 2nd, 2010, when the probate court approved the December 2009 final plan of the personal representative. So interest in this case under the new statutory regime would not have even begun to run until September 2011, which by that point, Miriam Barron had already been paid in excess of $42 million, well in excess of the elective share amount under the statute. So the elective share statute is a mathematical formula. It does occupy the field. It does not leave discretion to alter the amount of the elective share because to do so is to conflict with the statute. And I think that is the point that Mr. Westfall has missed. 1510.103 says, unless displaced by the particular provisions of the code. Well, the particular provision of the code here, the elective share statute, absolutely displaces equitable power to alter the mathematical formula that determines the elective share.
Can I stop you right there? Because according to your opponent, the formula itself is not being altered here. In other words, the formula was followed, a sum was derived from that formula, and that is separate and apart from the court's exercise of equity to add to that elective share number. So, what's your response to your opponent's sort of reframing of that?
Well, my response is that the addition by the probate court is the equivalent of adding another factor onto that statutory formula. It's as though, say, you have the elective share percentage times the sum, which is the augmented estate, plus whatever equitable factor the probate court concludes is there. The need for additional funds. I think that, as a policy matter, is a legislative policy judgment to make. And I think if this court were to uphold it, it could wreak havoc in the probate courts because anytime you have an assets estate with an elective share, particularly one of some significant value and with fluctuating assets, it would be in the party's interest to ask for an elective, an equitable adjustment. And it would be in the beneficiaries, the residual beneficiaries' best interest to ask for a reduction because of, say, fluctuating assets that are declining, as is the case in this court, in this estate. And I think the interesting thing is that in the Court of Appeals argument, Mr. Westfall was asked point blank whether a probate court had the power to equitably adjust downward, and he answered no. So Miriam Barron wants the upside, but no downside. There is no equitable power here to do what the probate court did. 1510.103 is not a sweeping grant of equity to essentially alter the way the elective share statute, which is specific and precise to the penny, how it operates.
Mr. Myrie, let me follow up on Justice Seid's her hypothetical. I kind of get the impression that you're saying that the probate court is absolutely powerless to do anything. I understand what you're saying is they can't modify the value of the augmented estate, But are they complete? Is the probate court completely powerless to allow someone to, you know, do it in justice?
Well, if there is, for example, a substantially frivolous or groundless or vexatious litigation, then the court would have some power under 1317.102, if the criteria for that were met, to impose certain sanctions, attorney's fees, and the like.
But if they delay it and it decreases the value of the estate, and you know, I did probate, and sometimes money is as important as getting somebody. And if they want to just drive down the value of the state, they realize that oil and gas is going down, let's delay it and make it, you know, decrease in value and punish them. The probate court, by your theory, is powerless. They can award attorney's fees, but other than that, they can't affect any of the distribution.
Well, I think the probate court has the power to order the estate liquidated. And I think Judge Stewart noted that several times, and she had thought about doing that. I think the probate court, and I think that was the problem here, is that she didn't take the steps necessary to sort of move this along, and the moratorium interest award itself expanded and delayed the proceedings additionally, which led to the incurring of an additional about $10 million in administrative expenses, most of which were the personal representative's compensation, which Marion Barron embraced wholeheartedly.
But in this case, the value was going up.
Well, it was going up.
So if liquidation wouldn't have been in the estate's best interest, right?
No, not at that time. But I would note that Miriam Barron and the personal representative sought to liquidate the holdings of Barron Energy, as noted in our brief, early on in the late 90s, around 2000, when the price of oil was low. And now the price of oil is declining again. I think this shows the danger of what the probate court did, because you have a fluctuating asset where parties' desires, Miriam Barron wanted to be paid in cash through 2003, and then switched as the price of oil started to skyrocket, switched to wanting distributions in kind. This is precisely why the elected share is a date of death valuation. It does not change. It does not get net probate income. It's not affected by appreciation or depreciation. And the probate court has no power to alter that statutory amount. I do want to touch on the interest issue briefly before I turn over to Mr. Riga. As we noted in our briefs, statutory interest is it compensates for the lost time value of money. And in this case, the $24.5 million equitable award should belong to the residual beneficiaries. Miriam Barron has withheld that and is retaining that now going on 5 years to compensate the residual beneficiaries for the lost time value of that money. Statutory interest is the appropriate remedy, as the Court of Appeals noted in both the Rogers and the Tuscany case, where they had parties who succeeded on a judgment in the district court, then lost on appeal, had to repay their judgment funds, judgment proceeds, with statutory interest, and the same result should obtain in this case. Otherwise, Miriam Barron would have received a $24.5 million loan tax-free. I did also want to touch on this notion of grave injustice. As I noted, Miriam Barron had received massive distributions throughout the course of this estate proceeding, $12 million by mid-2000, $16.2 million by March 2007, $22 million by June 2010, which was in excess of the outstanding elected share amount. And then she received another $19 million into November 2010. She also received $1.8 million in contribution from the son, a right which she waived, to the tune of about $1.4 million from her own children. Thus, she has had billions to invest, use, and enjoy for well over a decade. So there is no grave injustice here. The only grave injustice was the probate court ignoring the elective share statute. Thank you.
Counsel, I'm sorry, before you step away, would you, and perhaps this is reflected in your brief, I'm just not recalling, what is your response to your opponent's view about a general remand? If, in fact, we agree with you that it was improper to add the moratorium interest to the elective share here, what about allowing the probate court to sort of revisit the entire distribution, because it was structured around the idea that the probate court could, in fact, augment that elected share with this alternate interest.
I think that opens Pandora's box again in this case. I mean, given the litigation history here, I think that would, in essence, lead to another decade of litigation, and I don't think it would resolve anything. I don't see, also practically, how it is possible to go back in time and do what they asked be done in this case. And I don't think there's statutory basis for it either.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Chuck Briga. I'd like to address the Smith case first, because that case was handled under a previous statute, as you know, and doesn't have any bearing after the statute was changed. In that case, also, nobody objected to the moratorium interest in the case. And the FICO case, which is somehow has clear any doubt about that, it says that it's clear now that the moratorium interest doctrine has been codified, and it is clear it cannot be awarded except under the conditions of the statute. And then it also says it cannot exceed 8% interest. And in this case, as you probably know by now, in May 1st through December 31st of 07, May 1st of 2000 through December 31st of 07, the judge said, I am going to give you a rate of return that is the average rate of return for this estate over these 7 years. Then experts were all called. We had to value all of the assets all the way back to May of 2000 to get the first end of that. Then we had to value all of the assets December 31 of 07 to get the far end of it. The growth then was, took six years to get all of this accomplished with the trust. The number that came out of that was that the estate investment rate of return was 17.46% a year. The judge then gave Mrs. Behrens compounded monthly that 17.46%, which amounted to, by the time this was over and the court entered its order in 09 on this, $24,500,000 on this, what she gave her. Now, in that regard, you will know that interest rate amounted to roughly, I'll tell you what it was exactly. I called an expert in the trial, and he said the interest, what she got for January of 07 increase was $371,000. The interest she got in December, and you get this compounded every month, she got an additional $416,000 added to her elective share. That's what was happening, and that's what she was receiving. We filed a motion at that time because, with the court to try to change the date on that, because by the time we had the hearing, the value of the estate had gone down $52 million because of the oil prices. And that calculation was done by the personal representative. We wanted her to reduce that at least because of that huge reduction. She said she would not. One of the things that I thought might be of interest, since you brought up this and seemed to be concerned about it was the Court of Appeals decision relative to some of these same facts. They said on page 37, as explained in the statement of facts above, although there was delay in administration of the state, it was not caused by the wrongful withholding by the beneficiaries, our client. In fact, the delay of distribution until 2011 resulted from the contingent gift tax liability arose from the actions of Mrs. Barrett. And here's what she did. In 2001, she filed an amended petition. She asked for $9.64 million, that being money from the four sons there, plus gifts of Mr. Barron that she said were only his, although they were on joint accounts. We went to trial on that for 13 days because of all of the wells and oil production that was involved in that. And this is very lost on all accounts. But what that did was trigger the PR with the language that was given by the judge in that order that I cannot distribute any more money out of this estate until 2011 because I am worried that the estate may not have enough money if IRS gets onto this. And he filed a gift tax return and paid $3 million on the gift tax return, which then got through IRS. In fact, I can say that our clients were beneficial to the estate in that regard by reducing that gift tax return that he had planned on filing by $1 million by our expert convincing them that he was putting too much there. But that's what happened there. She never was deprived of money. In 97, he died in 96. 97, she got $4.5 million out of the estate on her elected issue. 98, she took out $2.2 million. In 2000, she had $11.5 million already collected from the estate. $11.5 million. In 03, she had $13,578,000 collected from the estate. And in 07, she had $16,900,000 collected from the estate, having been paid out. We, the boys, made many petitions for her to get money. I was the one that stood up in court and asked her to take the full amount of her elective share in the hearing in 07, and she refused. Well, it's easy now for me to see why she refused it, because she was getting somewhere around $300,000 a month more in her elective share with this treatment that the judge had created for her, the 17.46 increase every month on her unpaid amount. So there was never any loss of funds to her. And other things that you talked about, I know, the animosity. She sued the four boys in 2000 in Denver District Court, Bear Energy, the PRG, over all of the oil and gas wells that they had. They had been in business with their father for 20 or more years, all participating in wells. She sued them on the basis of undoing all of their drilling contracts and their payments. We litigated that, finally that case ended up getting dismissed on summary judgment, went up on appeal, but we spent thousands going through wells in Texas Colorado, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, over 1,000, I think up in Kansas, over maybe 1,200 wells they had to go in, not only in this estate once, but three times. The first time for the estate, second time for the Stewart May deal, and the third time for the 07 evaluation of it. And each time, we had hearings, and we would have these hearings on these things, and she, the judge, as you probably see now, in 09 at the hearing, finally said, "Oh, I realize why you people have been so upset about this. I made this big mistake and I never realized. I didn't intend for you to get interest as in accordance with the way my order in 03 was read as follows. You will get this income until final distribution." What she meant was you would get it till December of 07. She picked those dates out of the air. But everybody in the court thought that they were paying this distribution of 17.46% all the way to final distribution. And we went over and over and asked her to do that and rechange that. And she wouldn't do it until she had, I had the expert on the stand, and he was telling her that there wasn't enough money for all the rest of the year based upon how much money she was taking out of this estate because of getting an additional, at that time, $400,000 a month more than the elected share gave her. And so there was no waiting on anyone's part on our side because we were trying to get her paid. We offered, I offered for our clients in court to pay her the additional $12,900,000 in 07. And she refused. She said at that time she wanted to, she didn't want any more cash. That's what she wanted to be able to do. The judge made an order that she didn't have the ability to check the assets, to get the assets she wanted in this case. So we got to a stalemate in that regard. But when we looked at what we see here, a good part of this, and I like this just quite a lot, was a terrible mistake she made. She didn't realize she made the mistake, but it then cost everybody 6 years of thousands of dollars of reevaluating all of these wells twice, and then having a hearing on that and determining by another expert what the rate of return was and how we she could then collect all of that. And everybody was within, was trying to get it changed, and then, as you may have seen the transcript, she apologized to everybody. She even asked Mrs. Barron's lawyer, "How could you possibly have thought that I meant that this would go to a final distribution? She would never want to have this estate closed. She could just stay there until she ended up with the whole thing." And of course, that would have been true in that. But what we had in this regard is an enormous amount of animosity. Right after Mr. Sheldon Barron died, she went to the Office of Air Energy where the boys had worked most all in the four. She had a private, she was a co-PR then, had a private meeting in the office. She fired all the boys from their job. She locked them out forever. Made all
Mr. President, I appreciate your argument. Your time is over, sir.
I'm sorry, I used my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. So let's see, Mr. Westfall, I think you have about 3 minutes left.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. So much of what we're hearing here today in this courtroom is we're hearing the argument of the equities. For example, the assignment of blame of who's responsible for the delay. The probate court found the respondents were responsible for the delay, made an express finding to that effect, made that the basis in 2009 for the equitable award, and that finding of fact is well established in the record, as I pointed out. It was the original March 2000 filing that launched us into the decade plus of litigation. Yes, Mrs. Perrin filed a separate petition. There's lots of litigation. I can point to numerous points in the record after that time in litigation. There's lots of them. The key thing is the findings of fact by the probate court, which are well supported by the record. By it striking to have Mr. Riga talk about the state of Smith and why it's no longer good law, well, it was no longer good law, his analysis in 1994. His trial brief he filed that I cited to this court, and including one in 2007, citing it in Ray State of Smith, saying the probate court had equitable power just 5 years later. Mr. Meyer talked about my answer I gave the Court of Appeals, where I said the equity could not be applied to adjust down, only to adjust up. And I did answer that question. I've had a lot of time to think about it. My answer should be clarified. The answer is so long exercise can be exercised by the probate court, so long as it doesn't expressly contravene a clear provision of the elective share statute. That would be the answer. If the result of that is it can't be adjusted down in a given situation, then it can't be adjusted down. But you look to the plain language of the elective share statute. So long as the exercise of equity is being overlaid on top of the elective share statute, and we're in no way conflicting in any way with the plain language of the elective share statute, then equity can be properly exercised. So I will stand corrected for my answer in the Court of Appeals a year or so ago. Regarding a 2004 amendment to the probate code dealing with the elective share statutes and providing interest, that interest is to be provided. If you look at the section that is set forth in the supplemental authority that they filed under subsection 4, it only relates to the special subcategory of subsection 32093, which is just above that. And it makes it clear that that's a very, very narrow subset of transfers, if you will, that need to go back to make the elective share whole, and those have to be kicked back in, and if not, if they're not kicked back in, within a year's time, interest starts to run. It's very narrow, has no applicability to this case whatsoever. I'm not out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank all counsel for your argument, Mr. Westfall, Mr. Myrie, Mr. Briga. We appreciate your arguments today. The court is now in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.